You're listening to Visionaries by Wonder, a podcast where CEOs, founders, and leaders share their success stories with their host, Jeannie O, the founder of Wonder and an award-winning product strategy and UX design firm. We'll be exploring the world and connecting with inspiring individuals. Join us.
Introducing our next guest for today's podcast, Eric Lee Smith, a true serial entrepreneur with a passion for creating breakthrough products and services. With a proven track record of success, Eric has started and led a variety of companies from bootstrap to venture-backed. Eric's talent for product development has earned him numerous accolades, and as a game designer, he has designed several award-nominated games and won the Best Game of the Year twice with Victory Games. And throughout his unique career, Eric has worked on cutting-edge products that manage over $2 trillion in assets, transact hundreds of millions of trades per day. He has been a key member of teams that created financial planning applications for well-known companies such as Money Magazine, Fidelity Investments, and Smith Barney. Join us today as we learn from Eric's wealth of knowledge and experience in entrepreneurship and product development. So Eric, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Hi, everyone.
So excited to have you here. So tell us more about your journey. You know, you were telling me before we got started that you have quite a unique experience. So yeah, give us a little insight about who you are and how you got here.
Okay. Yeah. My career, as I mentioned, is not reproducible. It starts in a particular point in time. But to go back to it, so I'm the son of artists. My dad was an art director in a breakthrough technology called television. He was the first art director at ABC in 1954 in Dallas, Texas, the Dallas part of ABC. And they didn't know what they were doing, so he made it up. And for 16 years, he was an art director in television. I did kind of the same thing in computers. And I got my first computer in 1980. It was a hand-me-down from the game company where I worked. I was an obsolete Radio Shack Model 1. And as soon as I used it and realized I didn't have to retype game manuscripts, I said, I will never be without a personal computer in my house for the rest of my life. And so that's what I did. In college, I went to Pratt Institute. I have a degree in fine art. I'm a photography major. I spent most of my career writing specifications for software and doing software new product development, product analysis. And I've never had a single class in computer science. So I'm a creative guy. I'm a new product development specialist. Odd things about me, by the time I was 20, I owned 200 board games.
What?
I was a fanatical board game guy, right? So
how do you even have time to play all of that?
Well, this is interesting. After high school, well, the richest I ever was the senior year in high school when, with my camera, I made like $3,000, right? And this was an infinite amount of money.
Yeah.
Infinite.
As a high schooler, yeah.
I could buy all the Taco Bell I wanted. I could take my friends to every movie that came out. I could put gasoline in my Rambler station wagon. I could do everything, right? So after high school, I started a business with my camera. I rented an office space in an African-American life insurance company in downtown Dallas. I had two rooms for $50 a month. And I did that for 3 years, but that left me with a lot of time to play games, and I was so fanatical about games that I spent every waking hour playing board games, and especially military simulation games. And so when it came time to go to real college, I applied to four schools, and I got into all four, and one was in New York City where my favorite game company was. That's where I chose to go, and that was a life-changing experience because I became a playtester at Simulations Publications.
Wow.
Got a minimum wage internship. Got a chance to design a game called The Alamo. And it turned out well. And it's still in print 40 years later. It was nominated for Best War Game of the Year. Didn't win, but it was nominated. And by the mid-80s, I said, I got to get out of this board game thing. I've done all these games. I've won awards. But the microcomputer's here. And I've got to get into software development. And so I did. I left. And I became a consultant, and I joined a startup in Philadelphia in '88 that was doing simulation software about business simulations. And then that transitioned. We said, why are we making games about this? Let's do the real thing. So we did. And our dozen people, I was the only person over 30 and the only one that had a wife or a husband. And everybody else was like 25 years old, right?
Yeah.
But we did it. We pulled
that's
it
like
off.
The startup scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, it was. But there were almost no VCs then, and there was no startup scene. That didn't exist.
Yeah.
So this is all Stone Age stuff. I know. I got a lot of white hair. Stone Age, right? But you asked where I came from. So at that company, Reality Online, we did some of the very first financial planning applications, and we did online trading systems. We did the very first one ever offered to the general public in North America through America Online and the Prodigy Network. You could actually trade stocks. That was us. And we kept that going, and we sold to Reuters in the mid-90s. We got up to about 150 employees, something like that, big data center, all that kind of stuff. And I was always the head product guy doing that.
Wow.
And it always weirded out the engineers. You know, they loved working with me. And I have dear friends, many, many dear friends that are hardcore programmers and engineers. And they were like, I don't know where this guy comes from, but he writes good specifications. Well, because I write them like a game designer.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds to me, you're like the definition of follow your passion, right? You started, you started playing games when you were in high school. And as you said, by the time you were in college, you had over 200 games, which is crazy. I've got like two board games in my cabinet and I'm like, oh, that's a lot. That's minimalist.
I've got 400 here in my house right now. I'm down from about 600, you know. It's like, we moved to Albuquerque, got to get rid of some of these. So, yeah.
So you downsize.
I downsized about 400
now. Wow. What's your favorite game?
Oh, it's hard to say, but I like Settlers of Catan, Ticket to Ride, Alhambra, Tesoro. Card game I'm just getting into called Arboretum. Highly recommend it. Great. My wife and I really like Wingspan. Is a beautiful, all-female design, by the way. Very interesting.
Mm.
The female game designer, entire production team female, and a truly amazing game design. And, of course, it's a global hit.
I definitely want to get a list of your top games and maybe highlight that in our
podcast. Be happy to
notes
do that.
Or something. Yeah.
You'd have to give me by categories. I've got different categories. I can do historical games and simple games and... the ones that I like playing the most are multiplayer games where you can have both, you know, that are not that hardcore, but there's meat on them. You know, there's strategy. Catan is really the classic of that.
I love Catan.
At that level.
I carry that with me everywhere I go. Wherever I travel in big groups, I bring that with me.
The iPhone version is very good, by the way.
What? There's an iPhone version? I didn't even know that.
For 10 years.
No way. Wow.
Yeah.
They should advertise that better on their actual board that, you know, there's an iPhone version. I had no idea. I've been playing it for like the last
If you want to go play one of my games, you can go to Steam and look up Gettysburg, The Tide Turns. And it's a hardcore simulation game that has animation in it, but it's turn-based. It's not real-time. It's a simulation game. It's one of mine.
Okay. Ah, how many games have you designed?
At least a dozen, but it's hard to say. I haven't done a count recently. I'm working on one now, as a matter of fact. I always dabble in that. I always have. So I haven't done it as a full-time profession since 86 or so, a long time, right? But I've always stayed involved. So.
Wow, okay. So I want to dive in a little bit more about how game design has impacted your career. And then I want to come back to the games that you're designing now or the games that you've designed.
Okay.
So tell me how game design has impacted your journey as an entrepreneur or how that impacts you as a product leader.
Yeah, okay. Well, I introduced myself as a game designer and I always did. And I had these big clients, right? Vanguard and, you know, Credit Suisse First Boston and Fidelity and, you know, Bank of America and all these people, right? And I always introduce myself as an analyst. I'd say I'm a game designer. And I always have to explain that. So what does a game designer do? Well, a game designer is responsible for doing a couple of things. Creating an entertaining experience is the first one. And then there are techniques to do that. But if you don't get an entertaining experience, people don't play. And I, my career started in retail games. And let me tell you something. If a game, if you design a game and it comes out on a Friday, you know by the next Friday whether you've got a hit or not. So what this does is when you're judged that fast, you make sure you get things down and known. So game designers button stuff up and they do specifications. I was shocked getting in the software development industry how primitive their specifications were. They would never have gotten by Redmond or Jim at Simulations Publications. Never in a million years. Eric Goldberg.
Also, what's the comparison?
Well, they would, you know, the software development would like, oh, they'd do a screenshot and then they'd do 2 pages of description and they'd hand it over to the programmers and go. That's the core of what gave me the skill set to do the analysis with these big corporations that were trying to do important financial services applications for the general public. Because if they get abandoned right away, well, then, you know, financial planning is inherently kind of scary and boring. That's a bad combination. It is.
Yeah.
So you got to make it not scary and not boring. Well, that's tough. That's a game design problem. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. But I'm wondering how do you, because every product designer wants to not make an experience boring. They want to make it fun. And the new buzzword is like gamification. So how do you, like, what are some specifics that a product designer can take to have that, what did you just call it, entertaining experience?
The first question is, what is a game? Well, a game is a process you go through that has a winner and a loser. Mm. It has a victor and a defeated. Mm. Now, there's, you have active opposition or you have passive opposition, but you have opposition in a game.
What does that mean?
In other words, you have, you're up against something. You're trying to accomplish, and there's a there's an active opponent. That's what a game is. A game is an active opponent. Okay. So you never hear this term in gamification, right? So the so if you're looking at, say you're designing software and you're using gamification, well, you have to ask yourself, what are the victory conditions? These are game terms. What are the victory conditions? How do I determine where I am and where I'm going? And the victory conditions, like if you're doing financial planning applications, you have a goal in mind, whatever it might be, and that's your victory conditions and how you get there and how you monitor where you are along the process. And the opposition in financial planning is your own, you are the opposition, in effect. It's your own habits and your own interior dialogue with yourself. That's the opposition.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to overcome that. It really is. Now, gamification, so games are very popular, but let's be very clear about that. There's different kinds of competition in games. There's the head-to-head competition. The ultimate of that is chess. But in order for me to win, Jenny, I have to destroy you. I have to utterly crush you.
Destroy
okay?
me.
I have to utterly crush
you. You just win by 1 point.
So this is some people's idea of a great time, and it's most people's idea of a nightmare. I don't like chess. I played it as a teenager. And the problem with chess is it's in order for me to win, I must annihilate you. Also, the problem with chess is to get a good game, I have to play somebody that's near my skill level. Otherwise, I just wipe them out, or they wipe me out. So it's inherently difficult game. So that's the direct competition model, right? Now, there are other models. Let's look at racing. If you're a swimmer, you're a high school swimmer, right? You have your lane and you're racing. That's indirect competition, right? In order for me to win, I just beat you, but I'm not leaning over your lane and putting your head under the water. Now, so there's racing, right? There's racing. There's car racing, right? Now, car racing is a little different because there you can cut in front of people and you have direct competition, but not a whole lot. You can't, like, drive the other guy into the wall. But you can mess with him, right? So that's indirect competition. So, again, these are competition models. another competition model, the most popular on Earth, is called coopetition, which is in order to...
Coopetition.
Yeah, coopetition, which is, I think I got the pronunciation right. I'd have to check with some of my game nerds on that to make sure. But the point there is for us to win, our team must win, right? Mm. We got to kill the Balrog, or the orcs. But if they kill us all, then we've all lost. If our team succeeds, then within the team, it's where you are within the team. And I'm not actively trying to destroy one of my other team members, right? We're cooperating, but we're having a competition. And it's mostly competition for glory. And this is a very important gamification for software concept, is the concept of glory. We game designers talk about it all the time, right? It's it's usually the leaderboard. That's the most, trivial version of glory. Special powers are much, much, much more vital. D&D is the ultimate game for that. Like, the longer you play a character, the more real it becomes, the more specific it becomes, the more magic items they have. Pretty soon, they've taken over your life, and you feel like you are that character.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who stay in video games for days at a time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, absolutely.
Yeah. South Korea is terrible for that.
Yeah. Now, there's another kind of gamification that's really super important, and that's puzzles. Puzzles are even more valuable in some ways than games as a designer to think about, because they're older, they're more popular. People love them, and it's universal. All age groups, all cultures have puzzles. Mm. So gamification as a software designer, if you can put in puzzle-like elements where somebody can figure something out and something happens, and it's not necessarily a win-lose thing, but it's a kind of active solution building over time, that can be very powerful. And again, this is especially true in educational software, where if you just spoon feed people education, well, that's pretty boring, right?
Yeah.
But if you build in some sort of puzzle interactions in there, they remember what they learn. So there's puzzles, and games are related, but they're different. Puzzles do not have an active opponent. They have a solution, right?
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah. And so when do you use each of these techniques when building a software? Like, and I'll preface with, we have clients who come to us and they love the term gamification. They're like, oh, we want to make this gamified. And I don't think they really understand what that means. And they, for them, it's like, oh, let's throw up a leadership board.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have a leadership board for like a B2B SaaS company. I don't know how fun that's going to be for the users. Right. But they just want to throw it in there just because gamification is a buzzword for them.
Well, I think the answer to that is that each problem that you have that comes into your shop that you're trying to solve has a potential for gamification. All software does, all business models do, but each one is a little bit different. And so there are techniques you can use to take that question apart. What does a professional game designer think about? Well, here's something that you almost never hear except game designers talk about: session length. Okay, how long?
What is that?
That is, how long is a person going to be using your software? Now, let's say you're doing a software as a solution application. If it's something that your client is using every day at the core of their job, the design can be completely different than if they're using it once a month at the end of the month to do something. Because then each month, it's like, oh, geez, I've got to go re-engage and relearn how to use this thing.
Yeah.
So the process to engage with the software has to be extremely procedural to step them through, because they won't remember between sessions.
Right.
A tool that they're used real frequently can have a completely different design. So these are design questions, but they're related to the way game designers think. One of the things that I don't remember who told it to me, Jim Dunnigan and Redmond Simonson, somebody said to me, never make the gamer feel stupid. So never make the user feel stupid. And the easiest way to make the user feels stupid is using terms they don't know and abbreviations they don't know. So we go in as designers or as the company mm-hmm. That's the client that's helped you, they know their subject matter cold. So they're going to be using terms and throwing things around. Their own client may not fully understand that. You see this in financial services all the time, right? So you have to be very careful about presenting information and making the assumption. So game designers are very, very aware of things like that, bringing people along. Another thing that game designers do oftentimes is they'll create scenarios that step you into the game quickly that are sort of beginner friendly. You almost never see that done in software.
So how do you do that with something like financial services? How do you get them to do like a quick win?
Okay. Let's say that you were doing a stock trading screen. Well, what an amateur designer would do would just be put up everything you could possibly do on that. You know, I'm going to do trade options and futures yeah. and, oh, I'm going to do...
The dashboard.
I'm going to do... Not a dashboard. I'm actually talking... Once you've gotten past that and you're actually doing it on the trade screen, right? Well, they think, oh, the professionals all want that in one place because that's the most efficient way. That's what I was facing in 1990 and 1995. These overwhelmingly complicated screens. You look at them and go, holy crap, all that just to make a stock trade? No. America Online, it was about this big, right? We had You know, you take things out and you don't have the full-blown every option unless they choose to go to the page where that's possible. Otherwise, you know, make them branch into the simple version, like, okay, I want to trade a stock. Go to that. So a lot of it's a branching question where you branch into things that are simple early on where the user, the player, gets as quickly as possible to answer the question they want to answer to without showing them every option that they could possibly do. And these are not trivial design questions at all. These are really hard, actually. It's very hard to create simple screens, as your team no doubt knows.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Especially, you know, we battle with our clients a lot because most of the projects that we work on is in B2B SaaS. And so the founders or the product owners that we work with, they come with, you know, decades of industry experience, and they'll tell us, you know, using financial services as an example, they'll tell us, you know, our typical users are going to want to see all the trades that are happening in one screen. So we just got to give them all of it. And we're like, that looks overwhelming.
Well, here's the thing.
We're going to go testing, but like, you know, it's a bit of a battle with them.
So the use case is if the trading screen is used by somebody at their desk 8 hours a day, that's what they said is true. Mm-hmm. If it's intended for the general public, it'll be some guy at night doing trades or some guy at lunchtime doing trades. Yeah. He's not using it every day. And he does not need to see that. He does not need, you know, a Bloomberg terminal on his PC. Yeah. He just doesn't. So that's the use case of frequency and also, I guess, fanaticism is a term.
Yeah. I think that's how, I don't know if you use Robinhood, but I think they just totally won the market because it looks like a game.
That's
it's
correct.
So clean. Their animations are spot on.
Perfect example of a winning by subtraction. They won by subtraction. If you include everything, you provide nothing.
Yes. Yeah.
So the instinct is to include everything. The more you include, the more complicated it goes up by the square root of the objects you're dealing with, right? Mm. I sound like I'm a math guy. I'm an art major. So to say that took a long time for me to understand what that meant. I knew it intuitively until my friend Doug Alexander said, no, Eric, listen, the complexity is it grows by the square root of the number of options on the page. Like, that's why it's so much harder.
It's like when if you're presenting people with too many options or even like as a simple analogy, if you're like going out to eat on a Friday and you have 10 different options of restaurants as opposed to two, it's just going to be so much more difficult, especially if you're going out in a group of friends to decide where you all want to go eat. So, you know, what did you say? It's like winning by subtraction. And
yes. It's
one thing that I think is so undervalued and undercomprehended by a lot of founders and product leaders in the space. Like, they just want to add more and more and more.
Yes.
And, you know, what they also jeopardize is time too, like time to market, time to iterate, because the more you add, the more you have to test, the longer it's going to take before you get that product out into the hands of the users.
Yeah. My friend David Crita talks about cognitive load, and he uses that term a lot. Oh, he went to Yale. He's a real smart guy.
So what is cognitive load to people who don't know?
I mean, when you add options, you get that square of the number of options problem, right? You end up with a, no, when you go into, like, there's a coffee shop I love here called, in Albuquerque, called Satellite. I go there almost every day. They have this big board of options, right, of all these drinks. I never order any of them. There's too many of them, right?
Yeah. It's like a Chinese menu.
They're like, it frees my brain. There's so many options. And that's cognitive load, right? Mm. So you have to be very careful as a software designer about even being aware of the term cognitive load and change the way you design. And simple things like what should be bolded on the screen, what should be in all caps. These are incredibly important design decisions. Again, board game designers deal with that stuff every day. They deal with the issue of, should there even be words at all? Can it be so obvious that there are no words on the screen? That's really hard. That's really, really hard. But man, the guys that are really good at it, that's, you just go, wow, I bow. It works in Korean. It works in English because there are no words required. Wow. You know?
Yeah. It just transcends through different culture, different languages. So in software, you know, one of the big parts of the process is usability testing. We have a design. We go through iterations of test, redesign before it gets shipped out into development. And I'm curious if that's very similar in the game design industry, and how often or how long is that testing phase before it gets shipped out to the market?
Well, let's talk about testing for a second. So before I got on this call, I jumped on my handy iPhone, and I use a CRM to run my entire life. So I did a quick search. How many professional game designers do I know? I know 134 professional game designers. Every game designer, of those 134 professional game designers, I think 134 of them began their careers as testers. So if you want to be a game designer, become a tester first. And the way you become a tester is you become a fanatical player. You're a fanatical player and you have something to say. And you volunteer and you get involved and you call the company. People show up. If you have a game company and you have good games, people show up and want to play test. I showed up. Playtesting is super important. And again, I was shocked in software development how crude the testing was. They, you know, in the day, I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. And then they went the other extreme. They started creating these automatic cases where they'd write software to the testing. It's like, oh, okay. It's too bad the users are not computers.
Yeah.
So that's good for stress testing, which is good. Stress testing is good, but that's not testing. Human testing is actually very, very difficult. And the more boring your product is, the more difficult it is to find people to do it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. If your own staff doesn't like playing your software, doesn't like using your, you got an early indication that you got big problems. Big problems. So there is no magic wand on this. In fact, there's an opportunity, I believe. I've actually talked to an administrator here at one of our universities here in New Mexico about this, to create a true testing lab, a user testing lab that's actually like a game company's testing lab. Because there's nothing like it. I've never seen anything like that in business software or anything like that.
Yeah.
So it's probably a pipe dream. It'll never happen, but it's a need. And I wish I had some magic wand to say it's this way. But my experience is every company does it differently, and it all depends on their engineers and the time they don't have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I think that's the sad part, too. I mean, that's been my experience as well. For us to have to convince our clients that we need to allocate time and budget to do testing, they're like, oh, yeah, that's important. But then when we give them the line item bill that this is how much it's going to take to actually test their design, they're like, oh no, that's, you know, that's great, but that's low priority. We got to ship it out to the engineers. And they just completely skip that step altogether. And yeah. It's like, you're coming to us to design an experience for your users, and yet we're not actually designing for your users. We're designing for you, and then you're shipping it out to your users afterwards.
Okay. This is
such a flawed experience.
My friend Rick Bunker gave me this terminology 30 years ago, and I never forgot it. Testing is a CF job. If you do it perfect, it's a C or an F. If you do it if you do it perfectly, you get a C. Anything else, you get an F. So it's always going to be the super low priority for your clients. Now, oh, it's not important. Let's just ship. But then it gets out there in the market, and something starts exploding. And guess what? You get an F, right? If everything goes perfectly, you get a C. That's it.
Yeah.
Nobody cares. So it's incredibly difficult to get a client to allocate anything to testing. It's just the only thing that you can do is just say, listen, it's a requirement. It's necessary. Software breaks, and there are consequences to reputation. And it depends on the if you're doing software as a service, I mean, you can blow your reputation pretty quickly. Software always has issues. And it's better to discover the worst ones before the users than after.
Of course.
And it varies by industry, too.
I was going to say, it just sounds like the whole industry, they're kind of prioritizing all the wrong things, just based on like what we've discussed in the interview so far. I'm curious, like, what other, you know, if you can structure product development the way you see as the right process, what does that look like?
So you start with big answers to big questions when you design games, like, who is the audience? I mean, and it's not like theoretical. It's very real. The audience is from age 12 to 18. They're 90% female. They're, you know, it's a licensed product. It's yada, yada, yada. So you start out with that. Then you say, okay, well, how often are they going to play it? Well, they're going to be fanatical. Oh, are you sure? Why should they play it? Fanatical. You've got to answer these kind of questions. Mm. So there's the use cases of how often people are using it. Who's the audience? And then the complexity level. We've been talking about this. This is the include everything, you provide nothing. And the complexity level of software. And again, Robinhood's a perfect example of a simple application. Simple applications win. The longer a product is in development, the more complicated it becomes. This is kind of a truth. Mm-hmm. It's another name for it. It's feature creep. That's another term. And it's just a human instinct. And you keep adding stuff. And pretty soon, it's like, oh, well, the clean little application we had is now Microsoft Word. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah. Like, if there's thousands of YouTube videos out there on tutorials of how to use your product, then it's just like, are you really building it the right way?
Yeah, that's some issues there.
So when you start when you get introduced to like a new game, do you get excited or do you feel like you're totally desensitized?
Oh, sure. Oh yeah, absolutely. I love the box opening videos on YouTube. Every new game that comes out, there's a guy.
Yeah.
He films it. I watch those often.
Really?
Oh yeah, sure. And I love, now I buy more games than I play. That's a problem. Because if I played all the games I had, I would never do anything but play games, right? Yeah. But no, they're box openings. Oh, I'll show you one. Hang on just a second. You're not going to play this game. Okay, you're going to love this. This is Rococo, okay? It's really big, and it costs about $125. This is an incredibly intense game about being the fashion designer for the
oh, wow.
King of France and his lady, and it's awesome. And it's got the best box opening experience I've ever seen. I mean, the pieces are, it's just crazy. The crazy production values of this game that get people like me, you know, get my heart beating. And there's others. You know, I have Twilight Struggle is the entire Cold War It's one of the most popular board games on Earth. It's in the top five. It's top. It's number one.
What is it called?
Twilight Struggle.
Twilight Struggle.
And it's a board. It's a lightweight simulation game of the Cold War. Sounds like, well, how much fun could that be? It's crazy fun.
Would you ever consider like you doing a YouTube channel with a box opening? You have so many games.
Well, maybe I should do one for my next game. I have a game coming out this year. Maybe I'll do my own box opening. It may be a little bit too vain, but. Maybe I should do one about Rococo and just be an old white guy talking about how excited I am about the making dresses for the ladies of the court.
Why not? 15th. Yeah. You know? I mean, there's literally a market for everything, right?
So. Yeah, I'm there.
But so, yeah, let's coming back in full circle. I want to hear about the game that you're designing right now.
Well, it's deeply... It's got one interesting aspect to a general audience. I'm actually... reimagining the Battle of Gettysburg as if it happens a year earlier, which would have changed the whole course of American history if it had. And of course, the reason it didn't happen a year earlier was the Confederates lost an order. They literally had it wrapped in some cigars and it got lost. And the Union found it and went, oh my gosh, they're invading. We got to cut them off. And so they cut them off. So Gettysburg and the invasion of the North was truncated in 1862. So I'm doing a scenario that says, oh, the cigars are never lost. And Robert E. Lee ends up in Pennsylvania a year earlier and a lot better, a lot stronger. And what might have happened? Nobody knows.
Oh, wow.
But it's a simulation. I'm using the actual forces and the forces from 1862 as if they had shown up a year earlier. That's kind of fun. It's an alternate, what they call alternative history. It's very difficult to make a game out of because they're outnumbered 2-1 and they're all on the offensive. Mm. So about if I can do the Alamo, I can do Bentonville, right? So again, as a game designer, you have to solve problems like that. Just like as a software engineer, sometimes you're up against issues that look impossible to solve if you look at it in a conventional way and you have to take unconventional design approaches to solve unconventional problems.
So in this particular design, how much research do you do about the history, about the Confederates, about this specific battle? How much detail do you get into before saying, okay, this is the route that I want to take, this is the direction for how the design is going to be laid out?
It varies a lot, actually, but what most game designers do is they read the secondary, what they call the secondary histories, not the primary, going to the library and looking up the actual order, although I've done that. You typically read books, history books, and you find out the broad outline of what happened. Then you dig down and to figure out who was there and who did what. You have to figure out the map. The geography is one of the most interesting things. You have to try to go back in time to get the correct geography. And with a battle like Gettysburg, that's easy. They know where every fence row was, where every tree was on that. I mean, they know everything. It's a major, major park. It's just this cataclysmic event. So people have just documented it for the last 150 years. But that's not the case with Bentonville. In the case of Bentonville, I'm doing stuff that's never been done before. There is no map. So I'm actually going through all these original sources, like hand-drawn things, finding these things and like, wow, okay. Mm. And they don't agree, and you have to make judgment calls. And so it's kind of fun, too, problem solving. To take us too far down the road of simulation games, but, they're a small genre compared to fantasy and science fiction, for example. But they're my genre that I like.
Gotcha. That's fascinating. There's just so many things that I want to dive in, and we only really covered, I feel like, just the surface of
I like to talk.
All the topics. Yeah, yeah, it's so good.
I'm a native Texan. I like to talk. You can't help it. Sorry.
Well, I was going to ask, is there any other topics that we haven't covered?
Well, there's one. Distance team management. Given the number of questions you asked about that and the note to me, I think it must be sort of topical for your company as well as many other companies. And my take on that is it's very emergent. COVID has changed everything, and now we can actually do it. In the old days, again, pre-COVID, it was way harder to do it than it is now. Things like Zoom have made it possible to to do collaboration, distance collaboration, and the modern tools created in the last 5 years, Slack and many others, have made it possible. I did, last time I had a game company, which was 2014, 2015, we had our art director in England, and we had to use, you know, WebEx or whatever it was. It was a terrible experience, and it was very difficult, you know, and things have gotten better, but it's still a problem of intimacy. The only way that I know to get around it is to regularity, where you do it on a, you get in rhythms daily, weekly, and you have different causes for having the meeting. So don't just do some one gigantic omnibus meeting for an hour and a half and try to cover everything. Do a 15-minute meeting about some topic that's weekly, and then do another one that's then segue, and try to break things up. Electronic communication mediums are hard, or media are hard to get intimate.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think, you know, it's a combination of organization / operational design and also working remotely. And what I mean by that is, for instance, if your company culture is around meetings, whether it's in person or remote, and you have a lot of meetings, going back to cognitive overload, like if I see more than 5 meetings on my calendar in one day, I know I'm not going to get anything done that day, just because there's a meeting one after another, or, you know, even if there's like an hour space in between, it's like, what do they say? It's like takes 25 minutes for your brain to like adjust and start focusing on a topic. So it's crazy, you know? And well, so part of that is just how your company as a whole operates.
There's a quote, I don't know the exact quote. I think it's Ben Franklin. It might be John Adams, or it's one of those early revolutionary guys that says, if you work 4 hours a day, you can feed your family. You can have a life. 4 hours. But what he means by that is 4 uninterrupted hours.
Yeah.
And it's actually very difficult to get 4 uninterrupted hours.
Yeah.
It is. And it, but if you can, you can really, really push things forward. This is the on the business, in the business concept, which is from the book The E-Myth, right? He talks in that book about working on the business, which is... What's the business doing and how's it doing and what's the strategy and what's the plan and what's the, that versus in it, which is like, what am I doing every day? And if you don't watch it, you'll spend 100% of your time working in the business. Right.
Definitely.
You'll find yourself, you know, doing nothing but software development, not doing client exploration, finding new, not following the markets, not doing on the business. So this is an important mental model too, is,
oh, 100%.
How much time are you spending on the business? Is it an hour a week? Well, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So an hour a day, that might be enough.
Yeah.
But if it's zero, you're in trouble.
Yeah, because there, you know, as you said, one meeting after another, putting out fires. And I think there's also, at least from my personal experience, the difficulty of letting go, right? Like just thinking like, oh, this person's not going to be able to do it the way I wanted to, and having that inability to say, actually, I'm going to train this person and I'm going to mentor them and, you know, let them work in the business while I'm on the business. And I'm sure other entrepreneurs also struggle with that. I for sure struggled with that for many years. So, you know, it's a whole mindset shift.
Right. Well, one of the classics on that is in software development, you know, if you have a team, let's say you have a team of 10 and you've got a company of 30 people and the developers are working on SaaS software and there's a development backlog as long as your arm. The management team is coming to you, Mr. Product Manager, saying, oh, listen, we just need to hire another engineer. You go, no, if I hire another engineer, that'll slow development down for at least 2 months. What? They have to be trained. They'll be unproductive. They'll cost us time. What?
Mm.
And they won't be truly productive for 3 months.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, no, wait a minute. So you're saying there's nothing we can do to increase the speed of development? Not in the short run, no. In the long run, we should hire people. IBM was developing OS2, and they had 1,000 programmers on OS2, and they were coming right after Windows, Microsoft, and DOS. And Bill Gates was asked, so are you worried about, you know, IBM? They've got 1,000 programmers working on OS2. And he said, no, I'm not worried at all. If they had 100 programmers working on it, I'd be worried.
Oh, I see.
The complexity of that square root of the number of players involved, right? Number of decisions involved.
There's a little bit of complexity in understanding it at first, but I got you.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, wow, 25 would even be better. But yeah, these are problems.
And what other advice do you have for companies that are developing software, whether, you know, they're trying to gamify or they're trying to operate faster as a remote company?
I guess the main thing on that is clarity of the priority of the work. In other words, the value of the given features. You can't afford to spend a lot of time on low value features to your customer. Now, these might be high value in some way, internally or whatever, but you need, if you don't watch it, you can end up spending way too much time on the features that don't matter in the marketplace. Now, you're in the business of doing user experience. That's an area where the value is extremely high. So you don't have that problem so much. But if you don't watch it in software development, you can really end up spending vast amounts of time on, you know, single login, and is the feature value question versus its effort is a real trap. So it's a product management question. You know, rank things by their value and their effort, and make sure you always have at least one competitive advantage level feature in development at all times. Because if you don't watch it, you'll end up having all these Me Too features.
Right? Yeah. That's a really good technique where you list it, I guess to specify, it's like you list all the features or whatever task that you want, put a value next to that mm-hmm. feature or task, and then put another number, and it could be from 1 to 5. in the second column, you rank it from how much effort it's going to take. And if you want to make it a little bit more complex, you can say like how much it's going to cost to make it, and you start dividing it. So it's like value divided by effort.
Right.
So if the value is 5,
actually,
and
the process you just described, I've actually been using for almost 20 years. I call it VEP,
wow.
which is value minus effort equals payoff. And it's funny, I use a 1 to 5 scale. But the difference between a 1 and a 2 is the 2 is a double, and the difference between a 2 and a 3 is it's a double. I use the powers of 2
okay.
scale.
Gotcha.
For bucketing, so that there's no ambiguity.
Yeah.
Because you can always say, is it twice as hard to do that? Well, you know, it's like if you use a 1 to 100 scale, what's the difference between a 67 and a 68? No one knows.
Right. Huh. That's a great
that's
way
how
to
I,
prioritize.
And I can send you my article about this if you want to.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah, and then we can link it in the podcast as well. But it's definitely, I've looked in the market in terms of project management. I think there was only one company that took this method of the value and effort. I tried out their product. I can't remember what it's called. It's okay. I think they made it over complex. But it's definitely a great product idea, in my opinion, in case anyone wants to take it.
Well, an entire product you should be able to do in one side of an 8.5 by 11. And if it's a software as a service, it might take 2 sides of an 8.5 by 11. And that would cover all the features that are being worked on and that are planned for the next year.
Yeah.
I can show that to you.
I would love
not
that.
Hard.
Yeah.
But it's a different approach to product management, and it's lightweight project management because it does have the time component, and effort is time. But it helps you schedule when you actually have capacity to actually implement the things.
Ooh, right? Yeah. Oh, man, there's so many different, methods to prioritize better. And it's just, you know, one of my challenges is that there's just so many out there that, like, it's hard to decide on, like, what really, really works. Like, for instance, there's the Eisenhower matrix as well, and then you have the Pomodoro, and I don't know.
I use both,
seems
actually.
Like, it would be great to just, like, have a singular product that just encompasses everything.
Well, that's a trap as well. That's how you end up with, Microsoft Word and Excel.
Touche.
You include everything. I mean, my process has a number of columns. Like one of the most important in software development is the benefit, what I call the beneficiary column. Who does a feature benefit? Is it internal? Does it benefit us only? If it benefits the client, does it benefit all the clients for the software, or only one, or a few, or most? So if you don't, again, if you don't watch it in your software development, you'll end up making all these one-off features that benefit the client that screams the loudest, right? So beneficiary column is an important column of this decision about how you product manage.
Oh, I was going to say, I had another question, just going back to prioritizing features, and then we'll kind of wrap up after that. Because we were talking about like putting a list of all the features, prioritizing it from one to however many. And we don't want to ship out features that have a negative value. But you know, one of the things I was just thinking about,
you can ship them, but you try to avoid building them in the first place. Try to redefine them before you spend, because there are losing projects. Almost everything you do around security is a loser, because your client thinks it's free and it already exists. So all the effort you put into it, you will never get it. It's a CF feature, security, because they think it already exists. They give you no credit for it.
Yeah. So the question I was going to bring us back to is, you know, as a product leader, product designer, or developer, you're essentially listing out these features. There's a hypothesis that like feature A, feature B, feature C are going to be the top three features that the users are going to want on your product. But then there's also this, you know, Henry Ford quote where he says, if you ask your customers, you know, what they want, they're going to say they want a faster horse, right? This is a little bit of a paradigm between like, how do you decide what the users are actually going to want and need on your product, as opposed to something that's more innovation. It's new, but it's something that people might adapt to.
Right. Yeah. That's a, if you and I had the answer to this, we'd both be rich and living in Barbados somewhere, you know. It's a hard, it's really hard, but I'll tell you this, my experience is the closer you are to being the product, the more accurate you are about that assessment. But if you're doing software, whatever it is, the product you're doing, where you are not the product, you're not the user of the product, the more difficult it is, because you have to depend on other people's opinions. And it's just the only thing that I've found that works is you use these buckets and these powers of two buckets. Because you almost never, like if you describe a feature in a paragraph, and that's all you should write is one paragraph. Here's what it is and this is what it does. And you describe it, and you describe it to your management team or to your customer, and you describe another one, and they say, okay, is that twice as valuable as that? And they'll say, oh, no. Is it half as valuable as that? No. Well, then they're the same level. They're both twos. But they're not the same. No, they're not the two. It's a 2.2. No, there's no such thing as a 2.2. They're in the two bucket. Okay? Those buckets are how you do this. It's that level. And once you get used to thinking this way, what it does is it enables you to identify accurately what are truly competitive advantages. And that's what you're really seeking.
Yeah.
Like, what is it that's actually a competitive advantage? And they're very hard to find, and they're very hard to build, and they're very hard to ship.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It's like that for every aspect of your life, too. Like, as an entrepreneur, for instance, if you're focusing on those two-level value activities instead of focusing on the five value, then you're always going to be a very mediocre company.
That's as opposed to outsourcing that task. I've never heard that analogy. That's great.
So, Eric, is there anything else that you would like to share with our audience before we wrap up?
Maybe a book recommendation or two might be something that your audience would like to hear. A couple of my favorite books that I think are... The Design of Everyday Things changed the whole direction of my life. The most important class I took in college was a history of industrial design. I was an art major, and I had to get special permission from the dean to go take it. But I was a history buff, and I thought, wow, this has got to be great. So the Design of Everyday Things is a mind-blowing book. Anything by Tufte, Tufte, Edward Tufte, his design books, and he's done about six of them. Those are tremendous. On the business side, I like, The Art of the Start by Guy Kawasaki is a tremendous book. I like The War of Art. Entrepreneurs should all read The War of Art. I don't know if you know of it. It's a tiny little book. Most great books are tiny. And it's a great book about, and entrepreneurs are like artists, are out struggling with their internal resistance. And it's a great book. It's actually a very, very short book. Mind-blowing. So those are a few.
And so a couple more questions. The name of your game, when the audience can expect for it to be published?
It'll publish later this year, probably in the fall. It'll be called Battle Hymn Volume 2, and it'll be available from Compass Games, which is compassgames.com. But for most of your audience, if you wanted to look at some game I did when I was in my 20s that's somehow or another still in print, there's one called Citadel of Blood, which is a little dragon, a dungeon crawler that you can get on Steam. That's a little bit more mass market than Gettysburg 1862. But it's called Battle Hymn. We're coming up from Compass Games in the fall.
Awesome. And if people want to get in contact with you, where's the best place that they can find you?
Well, your audience, I don't mind. They can email me directly. I have the most obscure email address in the world. It's ericleesmith@me.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Eric, for your time. Really appreciate it. This has been one of the most interesting interviews I've had. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to our latest episode, and we would like to invite you to check out our other episodes for more thought-provoking discussions and inspiring stories. And don't forget to follow us on social media @WanderStudio and listen to a new episode every week.